Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
We're going to answer more of your cycling and triathlon related questions today, and you can submit them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast. Before we get into things, we have something that's actually pretty freaking exciting to talk about.
Very cool.
Yeah. The first live podcast recording in person will be happening. We'll be doing it Saturday, November 4th, 2017. And it'll be on the West Coast in the U.S. here. It'll be at the Rafa Cycle Club in San Francisco. And we're going to have a special guest with us. Matt Fitzgerald, we've talked about his book a lot.
Books,
yes, that's true. And we reference them regularly. One book that we've talked about at length is How Bad Do You Want It? A personal favorite of mine, and it's a book that I give to cyclists a lot, and hopefully they don't judge me that I'm judging them for giving them that book. But it's a really helpful book, incredibly helpful. He's not only a master on all things psychology in terms of performance on the bike, but also, geez, even in terms of nutrition and everything else, he covers a lot of stuff. So you can join us for that. Once again, Saturday, November 4th. And we're also going to do a group ride after that. We're going to head up to the Marin Headlands. If it's not raining, we'll get in a TAM climb there. We might even take the dirt way up. We'll see.
I'm guessing all these cyclists, when you get into a room, and we're going to talk just about motivation and how bad you want it for like an hour, and then jump on our bikes together.
It's going to be a rough group ride.
There's going to be some people, yeah. And especially people riding with us for the first time that might want to show us how strong they are.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Feel free.
Yeah, feel free. Chad's like, wow, that guy goes fast.
That's yeah. Yeah, so come join us though. That'd be a ton of fun. If you aren't from the area of the, you know, the West Coast or Northern California, I don't know if there's any place, saying it's better than any other is difficult, but no place so unique. It's very unique. Being able to ride across the bridge there and into the Marin Headlands is amazing. So join us for that.
Come yeah, please show us. Up. I have awesome. This fear that we're going to do it and there'll be like one dude who's got like a Trainer Road t-shirt. I'm like, how'd you get that t-shirt? No one knows. He sits there. He's got a Trainer Road hat too. We don't even give those out.
Yeah. We promise we won't plant anybody. But please come. It'll be a ton of fun. We're working right now the details on like refreshments and they have, if you've never been to Rafa Cycle Club, it's like the coolest cafe / bike shop / place to just relax. They always have racing up on the TV. They have a great little cafe right there, spots to relax and hang out. It's awesome. So
I imagine they only serve like espresso. Espresso.
No, it just seems like a Rafa thing. But totally, yeah.
They come to a cross race. It's cool. They have a van that comes and they just give out free espresso.
It's awesome, right?
Yeah. That's so cool.
They do it well. And if anybody has any type of hesitation towards the reputation that unfortunately precedes Rafa many times of pretense and everything else, it's really not that at all. You go to the Rafa Cycle Club, it's just a relaxed, cool place.
They look classy, but they're nice guys.
Exactly. Yeah. It's super friendly.
You can be classy and nice.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
It's possible.
Chad shows that. So
the nice part. Just kidding. Just kidding, Chad.
So please come join us. We'll be talking about this every week as we lead up to it. We're really excited about it. And if it's something that works well, it'd be cool to not necessarily take this show on the road as in doing it all over the place every week. But every once in a while, do these in locations that around the U.S. or who knows, around the world. So
next time cool. We could do 6 days of it in Breckenridge.
Yeah, that could
all
be.
Around,
you,
all right,
you guys
Chad?
Can. Enjoy that.
Yeah.
You could just... you could do what I did.
I'll Skype in.
You can stay in the hotel room and...
Can we cover that really quick? Breck Epic just happened, and we don't usually cover news, but we've been talking about doing this race. Mm-hmm. I saw 5 pictures of Todd Wells, Jeff Kabush, and Howard Grotz walking their bikes.
What?
Yep, there it is.
What?
Not because it was gnarly technical, but because it was just so steep and you're at 12,500 feet and they're so worked after 4 days of racing, you know.
Pretty good luck, guys.
Pretty rough, so. But it looks awesome.
I think we could carry the podcast, us two, and we just have a special guest each day come in from the race.
Yeah, I'm for it.
We could do it. Chad could...
I'll do race analysis on files or something.
Yeah,
or whatever.
That would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Heck yeah, man. I think it looks... The one hard thing is that race. I mean, it was gorgeous at single track 6, but this race looks like second to none in scenery, and that would be really hard for me. So
you'd have to stop Take pictures.
Take pictures, man. Yeah. Anyways, join us Saturday, November 4th at the Rafa Cycle Club in San Francisco for a live podcast recording with Matt Fitzgerald. Going to be a ton of fun.
All right, next up, I have something dumb to say.
Please. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because this is so obvious to a lot of people.
All right.
But it wasn't obvious to me. And I think other people will, they have fallen into the same pattern that I have gone into and be like, oh, of course. Okay. So with my, you know, weight loss and eating, and before I did, like, I've tried so many things, right? Like, I tried my carb blast and my carb trickle right now, and then I tried weighing my food, right? And then I did kind of, like, if it fits my macro, so really anything in weighing my food. And I didn't gain any weight on that, and I ate, like, whatever I wanted. That's just, like, that's science, right?
Right.
And then I'm eating math. More of, like, yeah. The endurance, the Matt Fitzgerald endurance diet kind of thing, just whole foods, vegetables, fruits, whole grains.
Imagine kind of, that.
Yeah, exactly. But and I'm just trying to eat till I'm full, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, nothing about this comment isn't about that, but what my pattern has been in the past is 2 weeks ago, I did a big week of, I think I did like 1,000 TSS in 8 days or something, way more than I can usually handle. Mm. And I felt really good. And I was doing some really big outdoor rides. And like my biggest was like 280 TSS. And here's my old pattern. Do this big ride. You get home. You're like, you know what I deserve? Some Popeyes.
A million calories.
Ice cream.
Some ice cream. Mm. Not the million calories, but I deserve some like let loose food, right? Mm-hmm. Like I would eat a pie. Like not a slice of pie. A pie. My wife makes these really good pies. Yeah, exactly. And during that week, you know, I was like, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of that, I'm going to go home and I'm going to eat bunch of sweet potatoes, some fruit, maybe some like this. I have this like whole wheat cereal from Whole Foods. It's the ingredients are like wheat and salt, and that's it. Like, with some berries on it, and some milk, and some cheese, and I actually felt better.
Huh.
So before I thought that these big, huge rides would just destroy me, but maybe it's what's destroying me is eating 1,500 calories of
garbage.
Yes, of Little Caesar's pizza with like bacon wrapped around it. And then, no, I wouldn't do that
the
one.
Bacon lattice.
I don't like
crest.
That one, but you know what I mean? Like a whole bunch of fried food and then ice cream because I'm thinking, hey, it looks like I burned 3,000 calories today.
Yeah, you're just looking at it through that calories only lens.
Yep, exactly. And I think I'm not the only one in the US and probably in the world who says, I deserve this after working so hard. Cool. And even Jonathan and I, after we did Carson City Off-Road, we went in Five Guys and man, we had, if you guys have been to Five Guys, the amount of fries they give you measured in pounds.
Oh yeah.
But even Jonathan goes, you know what? You got to do this after a big race once in a while, but not during a big training session.
Once in a while.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. More like sometimes it's more of anything like a mental break that you give yourself. Because I know for me, it's a struggle for me to constantly say no to the food that my body wants to eat.
You got to reward yourself from time to time. And if those rewards are, you know, extremely indulgent, you know, on the wrong side of things, nutritionally speaking, so be it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. As long as it's an occasional and rare thing.
Yeah. That's Matt Fitzgerald's take too, is like, you got to let loose sometimes, but just not all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was like every big ride. I just thought the big rides were so much stress.
Yeah,
you know?
Just make it the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So hopefully that helps somebody who's done the same thing after a big ride.
I've never been more excited to hear your nutritional journey.
This might be the first time we're almost in agreement.
Have you guys seen what I've been eating?
Like, no.
In the morning I've been doing... This morning I did, like I've been doing like a muesli with, it's like teff and oats and sunflower seeds, dates, raisins, and some other kind of nut.
Oh, wow.
And I'll do a whole bunch of bell peppers and snow peas, and I'll put berries on that.
Hmm.
And that'll be like my breakfast.
Hmm.
Pretty good.
I dig it.
My breakfast.
My breakfast. By the way, too, when
Chav was thinking a large dinner.
when I did another pro tip. My oatmeal bowls, right? To get 300 calories of oatmeal, it's a lot of, you guys have seen it, right? It's a lot of space.
It's a vat.
Bob's Red Mill Muesli, I fill it up in a small bowl to the top and I weigh that thing. And that with milk is like 900 calories.
Holy cow.
So you got to watch out.
Yeah.
But if you want to like get a more it's just easier to, I think, digest. It's extremely dense because you're supposed to like heat it up or let it soak, but I just pour the milk and eat it like cereal. So the oats are still like totally like raw and compact. So it's just, it's the weight I think is the same. It's just very dense.
Right. Well, before we get into questions, we have one more thing. I thought this was pretty cool. Sam sent this in. He said, "Hi, Chad, Jonathan, and Nate. I recently broke my clavicle while mountain biking." Ouch, that's the worst. For those that don't know, clavicle, collarbone. "And while limping back to my house, a couple stopped to give me a ride who had just come back from the trails. And they were listening to this fantastic podcast," he says. Could you give a shout out to Jenny and David for being such wonderful people? Cheers, Sam."
Jenny and David, you're awesome.
That's pretty cool, right? Yeah. Picking up an injured rider.
That's
awesome.
Well, I'm going to say that we're going to start marking that down for the a way to like, because we track how we get new listeners. Broken clavicles on the trail and pickup. That's a new category.
Exactly. We should just hang out at trailheads at the podcast playing, ready to take people. So awesome. Good on you. And glad to have you as a listener, Sam. I appreciate it. Ryan, he says, "Great podcast. Seriously, I really do love it and try to never miss an episode. 5 stars, no, 10 stars.
Gee, thanks, Ryan.
I think that you have to have 2 iTunes accounts in order to do that, but we won't assume that's the case. Yeah. Okay, enough buttering up. Onto my question. There's a thread on a biking forum about being able to put out significantly more power on a climb than the flats, and whether it is a mental thing or something else that's going on. In one of the responses, someone said their FTP is 25% higher on climbs compared to the flats. Is that possible? I've noticed that generally I can put out a lot of power on a climb, and my power meter numbers show that, but that is mainly because most of the climbs around me are relatively short and steep rollers, so I tend to hammer them and recover on the downslope, which is normal for most people, right? This seems to work better for me locally. However, on a long, sustained climb, I generally put out around my sweet spot range and power. Staying there, I can stay out of the red and actually finish the long climb without completely destroying myself. I don't think my actual FTP is any different on the flats or a climb. So is it possible to have a higher FTP climbing compared to riding on a flat road?" This guy's, Ryan, you're smart.
So we have answered this before, but we're going to answer it way in depth and never answer it again.
We're sticking a fork in it right now.
Yes, this is going to be... Sometimes we've answered more than one question once, and now we've decided to answer that question extremely in depth and never answer it again and just tell people, look back at this episode. So where do we want to start, Chad?
Oh, man, there's so much to say on this. I guess I can start by saying it would be simplistic, and I'd really like to say there's simply one FTP. I think we may have even said that in the past. There's an FTP, and if you can't manifest that FTP, something else is afoot. But the fact of the matter is FTP is really closely correlated to your maximal lactate steady state. Maximal lactate steady state is tied to, you know, how much muscle mass is working. So different activities, say running versus swimming versus rowing versus riding, use different muscle masses, yield different levels of lactate, therefore yield different FTPs. And let's be clear, FTP is not the same as your maximal lactate steady state. They're just very closely correlated. So one typically follows or is very similar to the other. So when we're talking within cycling, there really isn't a different FTP. There might be situations that cause you to manifest less of your physical capability, less of your FTP. There might be slight changes in the way you ride or the terrain on which you're riding, your body position or something that actually cause you to recruit different aspects of the same muscles. So there might be a slight change in the level of lactate. So there might be a slight change in FTP. But by and large, if there are big changes in your FTP, something else is in fact afoot.
Let's go on the first one. So like your position on the bike. Mm-hmm. Normally when someone is climbing something steep, they are sitting up more, their hip angle
longer
is open.
Hip angle.
That
different recruitment patterns, different resistance on the pedal stroke.
Well, yeah. So first, just the hip angle open more. Mm-hmm. Generally, people can put out more power on that. Triathletes know, and TT people know when you fold yourself up, that's a little bit different.
Right. Mountain bikers too. It should be worth saying that a lot of mountain bikes have longer front centers these days than they used to. So from the bottom bracket to the front, which means that you end up, even though you run a short stem, it also, the seat angle tends to be putting you in a position.
All of that can actually be viewed from a position of adaptation.
That's yep.
Much like you try to adapt to a time trial position. So you know what your threshold is sitting up. You do an assessment, you get your number, and you feel pretty good about it. Workouts bear out that this is in fact about where I operate when I'm at my max last steady state or maximal lactate steady state. But then you get into that time trial position and what gives, you know, I can barely maintain 85% of it, but as you spend more time in that position, maybe doctor your bike fit a bit, you know, and it's 90%, that's 92%, that's 95%. And that gap shrinks, and it's not shrinking necessarily because your fitness is changing, but you're allowed to, or you're able now to manifest more of what your physical capabilities are. You're closing that gap.
But when you're climbing too, the difference between the hoods and like the tops is so small that I want to, because there's someone saying, oh, you're in a different position. Yes, you are, but it's so small. And with adaptation, it's not a 90% drop, right? If you're experiencing that. So
it's not really even a change in physical capability. It's how much of your functional threshold power you can express depending on the position you're in.
That's the key. There's that constant, and then there are circumstances that are changing around that. You know, and it's not just, and we're, like you said, we're sticking a fork in this thing. So since we're sticking a fork in it, let's cover the inside stuff too. A lot of people always write in and say, my indoor FTP is different than my outdoor FTP. And that's, you know, once again, we're dealing with a constant and we're just dealing with different circumstances.
Yeah, so that discrepancy typically comes from a lack of cooling. It's just I can do one thing outdoor, I can do something else different indoor, not quite as much power. I just can't exert as much power indoors. What gives? And again, largely that's a matter of cooling. And cooling, whether it's ambient temperature or more likely airflow, because all the things you don't consider, even at a slow pace outdoor, you're getting quite a lot of opportunity to offload heat. I mean, the ambient temperature is obviously different, but that convective or that evaporative cooling, those mechanisms that are in place that are not necessarily in place indoors unless you have a good fan, make a huge deal. Putting out power is stress. Offloading heat is stress. And if your body is more concerned with offloading heat, and that is what it prioritizes, then you're going to do less work in terms of what makes it to the pedals.
Yeah, Nate and I sure realized that. And I don't know if you did any specific heat training like that, but one thing that Nate and I mentioned in the shower, a sweet spot felt really hard. You know, tempo felt hard.
Your work capacity is diminished, plain and simple. Or it's not even diminished, it just shifts. Your body's more concerned with cooling than it is with powering pedals.
Right. So there are some other things, and these could perhaps tie into indoor, but really let's go back outside with our mindset here. One thing, Nate, inertial load, that's one thing that can affect things too when we're talking about whether you're inside, outside, or flat, or climbing.
Exactly. So this has actually helped me a lot. And back in the day, like 10 years ago, I used to be really picky about this, but now that I have, there's trainers that are out with have a heavier flywheel. Inertial load is like, as you're pedaling on, like you can think about it on, if you have a trainer with a light flywheel, you have not much inertial load. And if you have a heavy flywheel, you have a lot of inertial load. And usually when you're outside, you have a lot, but you have even more when you're climbing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Or I should say, if you're spinning something really fast on the ground like that, you have a momentum on your side and you have a lot of inertia behind you. If you're climbing, then you don't have that on your side, right?
Yeah, but I got to say, in terms of this particular aspect or this reason for differences in FTP, I can't find a study that really backs this up. I can find ones that say there are insignificant differences, ones that have actually looked at it.
Yep.
Nothing's terribly recent, but you know, I think 2007, 2009 were the ones I found. Yeah. Just because they're not recent doesn't mean they aren't accurate. So I don't think this is a go-to. I think inertial load, if it matters at all, is so minor that it's basically inconsequential.
And I can just anecdotally speak to the fact that I noticed that because I'll be riding mountain bikes on really steep terrain, then I'll be riding road bikes on, you know, not as steep terrain. And I certainly notice a big difference for myself. And I usually spend more time at low inertia. So I'm having to start from ground zero, so to speak, after each pedal stroke. So that's something to consider that could be there. Now that's something, once again, anecdote. That's what I feel. But the big thing, I think.
I want to correct, I said it wrong.
Yeah, you were backwards.
I said it wrong.
We got you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, we got you. But the one thing that I find a lot of the time with this is, and I find myself questioning this when I'm thinking about, man, it's so much harder in this circumstance, whatever it may be, whether it's flats and I'm trying to maintain the same power or something else, how much of it also is my mindset and me being in a situation where I know perhaps in the past I don't see as high a power data or something else. I feel like we could be, you know, handicapping ourselves in that respect too. Who knows? It's kind of tricky.
Yeah, motivation is a huge aspect to be considered, whether it's indoors versus outdoors, climbing versus flatland, either way.
So actually, guys, my FTP raises when I see Chad up the trail or I'm in a race.
That's a change in FTP right there.
I'm being sarcastic
here. Let's cover that. It does not change.
It doesn't actually change, but it's the motivation thing. Like, how many times have you had your biggest power output when you're in the race that really matters, right? Because you go deeper than anything else. And I actually have found too, I've talked about this before, but inside on my easy rides, I can watch TV and it's no big deal on the low stuff. But on the really hard stuff, and I'm starting to get into, Chad, some of your evil cross workouts or cyclocross workouts. Mm-hmm. And I have to, I listen to like, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers, old school stuff. And then I watch a mountain bike race video at the same time.
Yeah.
And boy, can I go so much deeper because of the motivation
improvement. You find what works for you. So maybe outdoors is one thing, indoors it's another. But the fact is, you can create that motivation.
Yeah.
And that's like Downtown Abbey, watching that during like VTO max intervals doesn't work. I have like TV shows for different.
Yeah, if you need to keep the intensity low, maybe Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
My wife just told me this morning she was watching the latest Game of Thrones episode, and she said it was a battle scene. She would pause it during the easy parts so she could turn it on during the hard parts, just so she like was distracted and was like, it's. I actually find too Hard Knocks on HBO when I watch like the HBO football players, like, or not the HBO, the NFL football players trying to make the team, working so hard. Mm-hmm. I'm like, look how hard those guys are working. They're getting like beat up and hit.
And something interesting we'll cover here. If I was watching that stuff, I would hate it. And if I'm doing a hard workout, I don't want to see anything. I don't want to see a bike race, anything else like that. If it's an easy workout, I can put that on. Mm-hmm. But that's, that's the thing. I think the principle that I want to cover here is motivation is a very individual thing.
Certainly.
And you can find what motivates you. But the key thing that I try to remember is, if I am not performing to my max capacity, what I know that may be, whether I'm inside, whether I'm outside, whether I'm climbing, whether it's on the flats, whether I'm on a different bike in a different position, I try so hard to remind myself, to get my mind to tell my body, you can do more, and it's proven you can do more. The mind is just getting in the way, and or the circumstances may be affecting it, right? So I really try hard to think through that and to remind myself the fact that my work capacity is my work capacity and the circumstances surrounding it right now, heck, if I focus, I might be able to pierce right through them and get down to whatever that work capacity is.
Do you guys ever envision like races, past races or future races? Like,
That kind of goes along with what Jonathan was just saying about watching races and how it doesn't work for him when he's working through hard intervals. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the same boat, because when I see someone else suffering, it doesn't ease my suffering. It actually makes it a little tougher. And envisioning race scenarios where I know I'm pushing up a hill, same thing. It makes it a little too real, a little too distracting or almost negative.
Yeah, I look ahead to races that I'm targeting, usually thinking of an eight race. And then, but the thing is, so I used to ski race, right? And slalom and GS. And a lot of that, a lot of focus in that sport is put on mental conditioning. You're memorizing the course every time. And when I say memorizing the course, you're memorizing everything. You know exactly how the pitch is rolling and everything else. And when you do that and you envision the course, you have to envision yourself going down it. And it's easy to fall into a rut, especially if you're not doing well, where you envision yourself going down it and something going wrong. And I feel like over the years, I became really proficient at being able to envision myself being successful. And that is, that's a hard thing to do. It's easy sometimes to have something sneak in there and make you crash when you're envisioning yourself, right? Mm. Or have you getting dropped or something else. It takes a lot of work and focus, but I find that when I'm in the moment training for how many hours before my A race, if I can work to the point where I feel comfortable jumping into that race scenario in my head and actually seeing success rather than a failure, then it helps. It takes a lot of work though.
That race simulation brings me a little too close to reality. And when I'm doing these workouts and listening to music, I kind of need a little distance from it. It works better for me.
Interesting. Yep.
Back in the day in high school, mm-hmm. I was on a marksmanship-like shooting team in the high school. Our high school had a gun range in the basement. Welcome to Nevada. So we'd shoot 22s and we'd go to, when we do competitions, you'd have to wait for your turn. And what we would do is we'd lay down in a dark room for like 30 minutes, an hour, and you're just supposed to envision bullseyes over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I was then a music major in college. The same thing. You'd imagine playing the song the right way. And this is a huge thing with envisioning what you want to do is if I say, you know, you're holding a cup and you're walking across a room. Now, don't drop it. The first thing you do,
thinking of dropping it.
Like a teacup, right, on a saucer.
Dropping it, yeah.
Yeah, as you do it. But if you think about doing the positive thing,
yes,
and you keep doing it, and that's what Jonathan kind of mentioned. It's a key life skill for performance on kind of like stressful events, like shooting rifle team or playing live music, something
right,
like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've found that it takes a lot of time. If you do find yourself thinking that, you know, that type of visualization or anything else doesn't help, aside from what Chad was mentioning, because that's a separate issue. You know, the benefit of being able to disconnect from that reality when you're training is
that's the subjectivity of the motivation. Yeah.
But if you're in terms of visualization, don't feel bad if you feel like it hasn't or if everything goes wrong when you do that, because I've personally found that it takes years.
When I'm training and it's really deep, especially on mostly it's anaerobic or VO2 max, where like I really have to kind of shut everything off and I look down at my top tube, which I probably shouldn't be, but I just got to go dig really, really deep.
There's no shouldn't. I mean, if it gets you through it, it gets you through it.
Yeah. As I think about some hard passes that I've done in the past to win a race, or sometimes I think about something where I gave up a little bit too early and I'm like, you're not giving up early this time. Yeah. That happened before, but not again.
Exactly.
That felt so bad. It felt worse to give up early after the fact for the next like 2 weeks or 2 years.
Yeah, then the pain
years.
That you felt in the moment.
Exactly. Right? I'm like, you could have had 45 seconds more pain and felt great about that.
Well, that whole pain is temporary, glory is forever idea.
Yes, exactly. You know, we're getting into Matt Fitzgerald stuff too. He'll say too, there's studies have shown that listening to upbeat music while you're working out,
yes,
higher performance.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that I always do have when I'm training, especially when I'm training inside. One thing that I always have is music. Outside, I don't do it simply just due to danger. I don't want to put myself in a dangerous situation, but I guarantee you it would help me so much. I mean, every day we started single track six, we got Highway to Hell when we kicked off.
every day.
Seconds prior to the gunfire.
Outside, I started doing one ear, the ear that's not towards the road.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
one, and I can still hear all the cars.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I kind of enjoy it. Or
I put an earplug in the left ear. Yeah, I know I do. It filters the sound. It keeps it down. It removes the whole stereo aspect of it.
Earplugs are actually not a bad idea at all. And in the motocross world, a lot of athletes use them too.
Yeah, just a single, just on the traffic side.
From Trainer Road official position, for safety of your own life, please do not put earplugs in.
You get filtering earplugs that basically cut out wind noise, cut out certain frequencies, allow you to focus.
But you can still hear cars?
It's just earplugs. I've never had an earplug that cuts that out completely. You hear just those little yellow foam ones, the little disposable guys. Yep. You hear, probably still 80% of what you would hear with it out.
Cuts out a lot of the bad frequencies that you might be distracting.
The harsher sounds.
I'm still going to say our official position is nothing in your ears.
It's
wear a mirror
best.
And blinking lights and a headlight. So another thing that happens that's different, I think, for easier for people to climb is you can get in this tempo because there's a constant resistance and you get into this easy tempo where you're on the flat and it usually changes when 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. And you might be in the same gear at the same cadence and you look down and your power has suddenly dropped 20 watts. Mm-hmm. And it's not because, it's just because you weren't paying attention that you needed to up your intensity. Mm-hmm. We're on a climb that's, you can usually just keep the same cadence and it's a lot easier to pace yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, there takes less mental energy.
More continuous muscle stress.
Exactly.
It's basically like riding a trainer. I mean, there's just no relent or the resistance doesn't relent. Yeah.
Time trialists and especially triathletes, I find to be exemplary in this respect of being able to maintain whatever their power output is despite the pitch.
You get better at it.
If roadies ride with triathletes and they think that they're awesome, just wait until you get to a spot where the hill starts to die off and you start to go downhill for a bit, the triathlete will wreck you because they're so good at being able to, you know, increase their force and their leg speed over the top of that climb and continue it because they're just used to constantly sticking to that power goal.
I totally noticed that on some group rides with some local people. Yeah. They hammer the hills and then when it's not, I'm like, why did everyone stop working out? Like,
right.
It's
not about speed. It's about power.
Yeah, exactly.
And power then therefore is going to deliver better speed. So yeah, interesting stuff. Is there anything else that we want to add on this? I guess a recap, your FTP is your FTP. That's your work capacity that we're talking about there.
Yep. Yeah, and then some people, there is one other thing. Some people talk about different days, what different levels of recovery actually affecting or changing FTP. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't change FTP. It might change your lactate levels, but again, they correlate. And this would be a situation where they don't correlate as closely as usual. So if there's, you know, some sort of central regulation going on in your brain, just not allowing you to recruit as much muscle, or in any case, different lactate levels, not different FTP.
That's kind of like the discussion of form, right? After like 6 days of single track six, mm-hmm. Jonathan probably couldn't put out as much power on the last one.
Right.
Your brain was messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's exactly, different capabilities in the moment, but not a different FTP.
Yeah, I even get this inside of a training plan, right? Like if I have a really bad night's sleep or my kids are up sick or something, and the next day the workout's harder. That doesn't mean my FTP is lower, just I didn't recover as well from my previous workout, so everything's harder.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Louise.
Boom, done. Fork.
Fork. In
close it.
Close it.
Picture a steak with a fork in that thing. all right, next one is from Louise. He says, hello, gang. Hope Coach Jonathan is healing up well. I am, thank you. And for those that keep sending in well wishes, thank you. I've been cleared to be back on the bike.
Do you ever think, like, because we've talked about this, you don't know what you're not doing right? Like, all of us are kind of like, Chad and I are like rolling our eyes, like you're, you know what I mean? Like your brain's not there yet, but you don't know because your brain's not
kind of like a Truman Show thing, right? Like you're kind of like outside of yourself and you don't know it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking more like a crazy person. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I'm good. I haven't committed any serious crimes or forgotten anything important that I know of.
This actually brings up something important. Making I don't know nervous. If I've said this on the podcast, but after my injury, I was driving to a race with my wife, and she was racing, not me. And I was in a parking lot. And I was driving to the parking lot, and like in my blind spot, I would usually see it, but there was a mom walking a little girl, and my wife called out, oh my God. And I think I would have seen her before I hit her, but my wife saw her way before I did.
Yeah.
And that can be one thing is like your vision, especially your peripheral vision, isn't as good when you have a concussion.
Yeah.
So this is like, I thought I was completely fine to drive and be okay.
Yeah.
But I just goes back to the point where you think you're fine, but you're not actually fine. The doctor too that we have brings you through a whole concussion protocol. So after a point, she can say or clinically say you're fine.
And I feel like I've been unfortunately been through so many of them that I am good at being outside of myself and being cognizant of what I'm doing from like a third person perspective, so to speak, if that makes sense.
That might be you, but in my situation, I felt 100% fine, right? And I really do, after the fact, think it was attributed to the concussion, and I normally would have been just fine seeing that because...
I'm sure. One thing I want to say, because we've gotten a few people asking for us to say this, I alluded to this, but perhaps not fully, you know, I guess I didn't lay it out. My helmet is in the garbage. I want everyone to know that. So, of course. So I'll be out at, next weekend, there's a bike race that I was committed to and, still planning on racing it. We'll see how hard I race it.
Next weekend?
Yeah.
Which
one?
So
it's in Park City, Utah.
Oh.
It's called the Park City Point to Point. And it is going to be extremely difficult in terms of climbing, and it'll be a tiring day. But in terms of technicality, nowhere near what we were dealing with down there at single track six. So that'll be good.
So rule of thumb for helmets, mine is if it hits the ground hard at all, like if it drops out of my backpack and hits the ground, it's fine. Hits the ground at all hard, I get a new helmet.
Yeah.
Because there could be a crack inside the foam. And like I don't say it has to break.
Yeah, so let's cover that really quick. So so your bicycle helmets just have something called EPS foam, and that's the foam that you see in your bicycle helmet. EPS foam is designed to absorb impacts and compact when it hits, right? It's not designed to stay rigid. It's designed to actually crunch and crumple and
absorb
fold.
The trauma, yeah.
Exactly right. So as a result, what you have on your head is something disposable. It should not be seen as something that's permanent. It's something that's disposable. And that's always hard for us with how much we spend on our helmets, but that's just the nature of what it is. EPS foam is something that also dries out over time. Now, we're talking a long time has to happen with that. Also, like if you have it out in the sun all the time, it could rot it and dry it out prematurely, but it does dry out over time. So, you know, your bicycle helmet is something that you want to replace every 2 to 3 years. Depending on brands, they'll say different things. And I know it sounds like a strategy for the bike helmets to get more money, I'm sure that's also a part of it, but it's not worth holding out and wondering if those guys are just trying to get money or keep you safe. It's your head, like you said.
Another legal thing, I would look at whatever the manufacturer says and do that for the amount. And all you guys who have helmets from the 90s, because I've seen you out on the roads, get new helmets.
From the Lance era.
This is another thing too, is that at least in the US, they get tested to a certain impact rating.
Yeah.
And a helmet that is $60 and a helmet that's $300, usually the $300 helmet is just engineered in a way that it's lighter or it has more cooling, but it doesn't usually have any more safety aspect.
In most cases, it doesn't.
Yeah. What we like too, I think Jonathan and I, and you do, Chad, like the helmets that cover more of the back of the head, especially for mountain biking.
Because
when you crash, it's not a smooth surface like a road. Yeah. There could be a big rock that's going to hit you right there.
Also, I like helmets that have a little bit more substantial back end to the head rather than something that's like a so vented and so like kind of like splint. Like if you notice back in the day, the helmets used to be a little more pointy in the back, kind of like a lot of protrusions coming out there. It made for an easy crumple zone, which was good to a certain extent, but it also made for something that wasn't quite as strong back there. It's good to see more helmets just putting more material back there and strategically placing those exhaust vents. It's
the other thing that I see for newbies, which is my wife does this, you see it in a lot of triathlons, someone here who she's a new triathlete does it. When they put their helmet on, it's too high up.
Yarmulke style.
Yeah. So you think about it, if you're going to land straight forward on your face, there's got to be that lip there for your helmet to catch it, or else your face is going to catch it.
Basically sit right above your brow line.
Exactly. Yeah. The gap. So in the skiing world, it's called a gaper gap. And what we talk about is you want to eliminate that gap, not embrace the gap, but eliminate it. So bring your helmet down so that there's no gap in between your helmet and your goggles.
It's almost
in the
like
ski
a visor.
World. And in the cycling world, bring it down so it's close to those glasses. You see even a lot of pros that wear their helmets like that. And part of it also is if you have a helmet that doesn't fit right, then it might not sit on your head well. But if it doesn't sit on your head well, just get a new helmet. It's not worth, you know, like it's just not, there's no point in having a helmet that isn't serving well. But yes, don't show off your forehead.
It looks
drop
better
it down.
Too. You look more
way
pro,
better.
Right?
Totally. Yeah. So. Yeah. So, and I'll be, when I go to Park City, though, the reason I was bringing this up, which that's going to be a cool race, by the way, I'm excited for it, but I am going to, POC's headquarters are there. So they already have an order for me and everything else. It's all there. I just have to pick it up. So I'll have brand new stuff.
Oh,
so.
Okay. I got a request for you later on.
Okay, cool.
I need a screw for my helmet for my visor.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Good call. So let's cover this really quick. He says, I have a question about bike fit. There are different bike fits available in my area ranging from less than $100 all the way up to $400. You guys think the fancy fits with computers, lasers, and unicorns are worth it? I want to do a unicorn fit. Yeah, that'd be cool. I'm no pro, but train hard on trainer road and on the road soon to be racing. Thank you for your opinion.
Yeah, straight out of the gates. Let's be clear. You don't have to be a pro to have a or to need a proper bike fit.
Good point.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is Luis, by the way. I don't know if we mentioned.
Yes, Luis. It. Yep.
So I have probably spent the most money on bike fits out of us.
I added it up while I was, I did some research on this, which we'll go into in a bit. And I added it up and I've spent $350. That's it. Nate, you've spent substantially more, I think.
I want to say
$400 or $500 here.
Close to 3,000. Good.
Yikes.
But so I'm going to tell you my experiences. Early on. So, and this is both, I've done road, like from a TT guy and then like a tri guy. Okay. Three different types. The first one, I drove to San Francisco. I was new. I was on a road bike. I don't know how much that one. It was expensive. And sometimes they always want to do mechanical work on your bike, and they always charge me that as part of the fit. Yes. So that's another reason why it's so high. But this guy, he had lasers on me, and it was like laser measurement. And he was measuring all my bones and stuff. And he had also done the Tour of California, some team that was going to race in the Tour of California. I think it was actually BMC. It was something big, though, right? Like a big team. He knew what he's doing. This is for TT position. He put me in a position where I was there and I'm like, this really hurts. And he's like, put your back down. And I'm like, I could hold it for like 4 seconds. Like literally,
but you
it hurt so bad. And he goes, you look really good though. And I would be like, he's like, you'll get used to it.
Oh, within reason, you may be able to adapt to a position, but if it's unreasonable, it's not possible.
I never got used to that fit.
Yeah.
Right?
You're not going to get used to something you can't even sustain for 5 seconds.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. And I was a new rider at that time. I was probably 3 or 4 months in. Hmm. So maybe that's too part of it, but the saddle to the position, you know, the tender bits were just on fire. And that was the biggest part where I couldn't fit there.
I'm of the opinion that you get onto a bike fit in the case of a time trial bike, I slip into my new position and right away it feels comfortable. I know 5 minutes, 10 minutes from then, it's not going to feel comfortable, but the fact is it's initially comfortable. So I know I've got something I can work with.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's a good point. Yeah.
My next bike fit was at Davis Wheel Works, and I think it's Joe there. And we did that, and he did some measurements, but it was a lot of eyeballing. That took like seriously 7 or 8 hours. And I remember being there, and they had like Lance Armstrong's video like on the wall about him going through the tours. And it was before he got all the doping popped. Stuff. Yeah, popped for it. I watched that video like 8 times through. Oh. And what he would do is, but it was cool though. He put me in a position and he'd go, hey, go ride it. And I'd go ride down this stretch back and forth. And I would complain about something and he would adjust me and he would adjust me and he'd have to like change cables.
Adjust you or the bike?
Both. Yeah. Okay. He'd adjust the bike and then tell me how to ride a little bit differently.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sounds like a really thorough approach, but you're not advocating spending basically an entire day getting a bike fit.
I'm not advocating it, but I'm just telling my experience. So that was, and that one, I rode that fit for a long time. And then locally I did one, a retool fit, and, the retool fit, which is they put like little sensors on your body and you ride it. And then there's a camera that picks up those sensors.
Yeah, so those sensors actually float on the skin though, because they're taken into account that things move while you move.
They're a little sticky.
It's a dynamic sensors. Fit.
Yep.
And then it puts it into like a system and they can say, here's your exact hip angle. It's just a better way to measure all the body parts on you. Mm. And the retool said that my triathlon position was really, I was like as aggressive my drop as a 40K time trialist. Hmm. So it kind of goes from like 40K to I think maybe Olympic triathlete half, then Ironman being like more and more up. And my fit difference between the retool one and the one where the Davis Wheel Works guy, the only difference was I got a shim in my cleat, like this tiniest shim. Everything else between those two, the retool one and the one from Davis Wheel Works, it was same.
That's pretty impressive.
I spent a lot of money on that. Yeah. And the guy's like, yeah, you're actually good. And I was like, okay,
nice.
I'm good. So my point on that is I think it's more the person, the fitter, than the fit system.
Yeah. So I agree.
Or a mix of both.
Yeah. So it has to be both, right? I did a deep dive on this stuff and looked into what, there are a lot of different options that you can have. And there are systems and then there are tools. And then there's the actual bike fitter, which is the person that does it. And those three things are separate elements of a bike fit that you want to understand and know what you're dealing with in each case. Way back in the day, there was the Le Mans fit where you basically just measured your inseam. Really, that was basically it.
And standover height.
Yep. And then your inseam decided the rest of the bike for you. And that's why we see so many people look like they're laying down on their top tube just to try to reach the top.
I can't tell you how often driving or even riding, I see people and I just want to hop off my bike and just do something, just do one thing, just raise or lower their saddle.
Right.
Just right then and there. Just spare them that agony.
And I see so many people stretched out so far, over the front.
There's one dude locally who is stretched out so far and I always see him and I his stem is so long and I just want to yell at him. I agree.
Yeah. I just want to help him out.
And now you help him out.
The Le Mans, so that was like the Le Mans fit way back in the day. And then a bunch of other systems came around pointing out the obvious flaws and just using your inseam to fit a bike. And especially these days, it's actually much more important because you have varying top tube lengths of pretty wide ranges with different brands. And if you were to trust just the actual height of the seat tube, you're going to get a very different experience. So then there's things like wobble knot, and wobble knot just basically, instead of looking at that, they are looking at your inseam. They said, well, we should measure the lower leg, the upper leg, the lower arm, the upper arm.
Yeah, they do a lot of bone measurements and a bit of flexibility assessment.
Some stuff
not,
there too.
Not enough. If anything, if they have a weak link, it's the fact they don't account for the flexibility imbalance or flexibility issues and muscle imbalances.
Mm-hmm. And there's a local fitter here who does wobble knot and he has fit you, and you are a big fan, right? Of the fitter system.
I am very
system.
Much. Yeah, because, but I also had the luxury of going back. His name's Bernie Harris. And I've had the luxury of going back and working with him. So if something wasn't quite right, I've gone back and he's tweaked it. And he'll do that for anybody. But if you're not local, that presents a bit of a problem.
I think Chad, too, looks fantastic, especially on his TT bike.
He does.
Yeah,
he looks super good.
I mean,
I don't want you guys to think this is weird, but Chad looks fantastic on all the bikes that he has.
Yes.
And what I mean is his bike fit and the way he holds himself on the bike.
Let me talk to that, too, because there's I've gone through, and I won't say various fit systems, but I've done like bike shop fits, and then I went to the Wobble Knot fit, and it did it basically showed me maybe small areas where I could use a bit or benefit from a small tweak here and there. So it basically gave me a basis upon which I worked. So now I don't need a fit. I get a bike, I get on it. If something doesn't feel right, I make minor changes. Sometimes I swap out a part. That's infrequent. Fact is, I base all this on a proper fit at one point in time, but I haven't needed one since because I'm very in touch with what my bike should feel like.
That's a good point.
Bikes.
From there, Dan Enfield from Slow Twitch, he has the FIST system, which is basically a setup similar to Wobble Knot in the sense that you take more measurements. And then this is where things get from here, everything's going to be more or less the same. But with FIST, he has algorithms in place, just like Wobble Knot does, to find out ideal placement of different aspects of your bike. But here's the interesting thing that I think FIST does is basically it looks like these are the key measurements we want to retain the same. Or I should say key points that we want to retain the same on your contact points on your bike. Now, let's look how we can shift that with different geometry on a bike, maintain those points, but shift you perhaps at a different seat tube angle is what they really use. Mm-hmm. So then, because Dan, of course, he made Quintana Roo and Legend of the Tri World for innovation. He's more on the tri side of things. So they're trying to put you into, no pun intended, but they're trying to put you into a position that's more aerodynamic, but still retain an effective position that you're going to be using. Yeah. So a lot of brands actually that we know now more famously for bike fitting stuff like Retool, like Guru, like Shimano, like everything else, they utilize the principles from FIST. I know Guru does for sure because they explicitly state such, but I don't know if the other ones use it. I wouldn't be surprised to hear if they were using something similar. They just didn't say that they were using FIST. But all the systems that I've found that are common, that are even fancy lasers up above, they are all the tools that I mentioned there. They all use a similar system to that.
Yeah. I hope we can get Dan Enfield. He's the,
it'd be awesome.
He also has slowtwitch.com. That's his site, Slowman, when he's on that site. It's all about triathlon position. And he pretty much tries to take the road position and your hip angle and keep that open in your tri position.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
Mm-hmm. And they do that. It's all tri related too, because I know at least they used to have it. Do they still have it in road racing where you can only, your tip of your nose, your saddle has to be a certain. Mm-hmm.
It's very specific, depending on the level of competition or the governing body.
Yeah, so it has
it
to be
incredibly specific.
A certain distance behind your bottom bracket.
Correct.
Triathlon don't have that. So that's just where you see triathletes either push their seat forward. There's been like products that kind of like will get your road seat way forward, or what they've done is steeper seat tube angles in triathlon. Correct. And Dan's a huge on, you, before you buy your tri bike, you get fit, and then we'll show you the bikes that will fit on you, rather than you buy the bike and then try to fit to that.
That's smart.
He is, yeah, so he's huge on that.
So there's something interesting that, body geometry and Retool, so specialized bot Retool, body geometry is specialized fit deal that they have, and they just use the Retool bike within that. And basically the way they approach things is they look at it, they interview you to find out your goals and past injuries. After that, they do a not a fitness assessment, but they're basically looking at mobility and seeing how your body works, and you're just laying on a table. So they're checking to see how your hips are tight or anything else like that. Then they put you on the bike and then they start adjusting things, but they look at it from a picture of, we're not just going to adjust the position on the bike with, different stem lengths or different angles, different heights, whatever. Then they change, like you had a shim in your cleats or in your shoes or a different insole or different gloves or a different saddle. They kind of look at it from using all of those pieces. That's what specialized in body geometry does. And they use the Retool bike to,
what is that Retool
quickly
bike?
Move it. So basically it's a static, or I shouldn't say it's a static, but it's a stationary bike. And it has gears that allow you to raise the front and then raise the back and then move fore and aft position as well of the saddle and then also the handlebars. So that allows you to
change the seat tube angles.
Yeah, on that one you can as well. The interesting thing about that is, you can basically validate something pretty quick in terms of if it makes you feel better. Guru, though, the interesting thing is, Guru has and a lot of Retool ones I think now use power too, but Guru has a power meter built in. They show your power in front of you and they can make these adjustments on the fly from an iPad or from a tablet. Mm. The interesting thing about that is the fact that you may be in a position and then they may change something and The difficulty here, we talked about mental interference before.
There are a lot of things that can change your power output aside from position.
The difficulty here is that if they're saying like, now I'm going to make a change, it's going to make you feel really good. Mm-hmm. And they make this change and you're like, that feels really good.
You know? Simply try harder, you believe, whatever. There are other factors to be considered.
Hopefully your power output, if you maintain the same power output in an ideal world with no mental interference, the position that you'd be in, you would have a lower rate of perception for the same amount of power output, right? That's the ideal, and that's what they're shooting for. And the interesting thing about the guru one is that it tips you up or fore and aft. It can do that, which I'm not really, who knows there. That's a little shaky, but the afterward, what it does is it recommends, they have a catalog of every bike pretty much. Mm-hmm. And then they say, if you were to go with this bike in this size, you would need this stem at this length, at this angle, you would need this in this position. That's something that's pretty interesting, especially if you're the type of person with an open wallet looking to buy a TT bike, let's say. Then you could go with this beforehand, and then you could find out what you would want to get.
I'm going to say not even an open wallet, because you would save so much money going through different stems and spacers. And this is why when I went to Fitworks in Davis, California, it took so long, because he's like, okay, you need some more spacers and you need to change this. And he would take the bike off. Someone else would walk in the shop and he had to adjust all that. Where on this, dink, dink, right? Push the button twice. You're like, you're now up 2 centimeters.
Right.
Right. And now you can you can try it again. Mm-hmm. And I think the power thing, nah. But I think the good thing about this is you can, like in my San Francisco one, I could, you know right away if it hurts, right?
Totally.
And then he could have just raised me up and been like, hey, when does it stop hurting? And I'm like, oh, when I'm up 2 centimeters. Mm-hmm. And then I could have gone from there. And then hopefully, I think all good fitters too like to have a relationship with you where it's not just one and done.
As it should be.
Yep. You go out there and if it's a new bike too, you have a, they don't like cut your steer tube too early.
Right.
And you can always come back and make small adjustments.
It's a process. It needs to be a process, especially initially.
And something that I want to cover, we've just talked about all the tech behind this and the tools and everything else. I've read now multiple accounts where people got like those guru bike recommendations. And one guy said that I think that he rode a 52 and then it was recommending that he ride a 58. And he's like, I can't even clear the standover height on it, right? Like not even possible. So there are mixed results from the tech. The most important thing is that you have a person that knows what's going on that's running this fit. Yeah. It's so important. No matter what you do, I have friends at Specialized that are body geometry fit certified, and they have told me, if you go to this place, I really trust this person. They don't say, go here, they have amazing tech and they have lasers. They say, go here, I really trust this person. He has experience fitting a person like you.
That's the biggest thing. Yeah, that's the hard part too, is it's really just like word of mouth, because there's no like reviews online, at least that I know of, like you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe ask
unfortunately,
around.
I mean, fitters have to start somewhere too in terms of level of experience. First couple of fits probably aren't going to be the best fits they ever do, but you know, the more fits they do, the more trustworthy they become.
Hopefully they can be like train with somebody, right? So like ideally, Bernie locally.
Ideally, yeah.
You could go work with him for 6 months and get better and then...
That's the key. Last parting note on this is if you are a mountain biker, find somebody that really knows how to fit a mountain biker, but not just mountain bikes. If you're an enduro rider, try to find somebody that knows what they're doing with enduro. If you're an XC, that type of a thing. Because bike fits, as we're seeing, as bikes change more and more and get more specialized, the fits within them, within reason, there are certain things that stay consistent, but what you need to do to that bike to make it fit well will be very different. So.
And the mountain bike, it's crazy because it's the amount of sag you have.
Yeah, and then the suspension in there that affects geometry.
Riding you're doing, because when you're sitting there, oh, this feels good on with whatever stem pretty much. I think that feels good. But then when you're on the trail descending, you're like, whoa, this stem is not the stem for me.
All right, and last one is from Duncan. He says, I take thyroid medication every day when I get up, two small sugar-coated pills. Will the sugar coating negate the effects of working out fasted before breakfast? Should I change my routine and take the pills after the workout? And then he says, timing doesn't matter medically, but it's easy to remember if you keep the same routine. Thanks for the fantastic podcast. Only been listening a week or two, but I've already worked my way through 20 so far. So,
you must be sick of us.
One really quick thing, Chad, before you dive into this, the reason I threw this in here is I figure that actually a lot of people probably take some type of a pill with perhaps a sugar coating.
Why do they put sugar coating on pills? So you're swallowing them.
I know, right?
I don't know.
Having a clue.
Just because sugar needs to be part of everything, apparently. Duncan, the fact of the matter is that anything aside from, you know, pure fat or water really is going to break your fast. So it will affect your fast and some of the benefits, but it's also tied to the amount of the sugar ingested. So the insulin response to whatever it is, whether it's protein or a sugar-coated pill or even multivitamins, I've seen that too. It's going to be minimal. It's short-lived. So it's just basically you're interrupting the fast. So you're going to burn through that sugar. Once the sugar's gone, you're basically back in a fasted state. So if you can postpone the pills till afterwards and you're concerned with interrupting your fast, then do so. There's no reason why not. But the impact is minimal. It's nothing I would really recommend anybody concern themselves with. But if you have the option, why not do it after?
I would think that the amount of grams of sugar would be like a quarter gram.
It'd be so
less
quick.
Than that.
It'd be a blip. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably people who brush their teeth poorly, had something in their teeth came out.
Exactly. So it's not like, you know, downing a bottle of Gatorade or eating a banana or a goo packet or something. This is, like I said, it's a blip on the radar.
Awesome. Well, it's good to know. So you can keep on fasting. All right, guys. Well, that covers it for this week. Everybody, thank you for submitting your questions. You can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can review this podcast on iTunes. Please give it 5 stars or let us know what we can do to make it a 5-star podcast for you, and share it with your friends. We'll talk to you all next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.